You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
All right, folks. We're going to start this next panel, which is called Living Our Lives Online, Are We and the Net Ready? And just really briefly, I want to introduce our moderator for today, Dan Caprio, who has the second longest title of all the panelists and moderators today. Dan is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Technology Policy and Chief Privacy Officer for the Department of Commerce. Dan?
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, everybody, for attending early on. Can you hear me?
No, not yet.
Not yet. Sir?
Are we on?
Are we on?
Can we have these lapel mics?
Are we on?
We're on.
We're on?
We're on. Well, good morning, everyone.
Yes.
Thanks, Tim, for that introduction, and thanks to the Internet Caucus. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, we still can't.
Still can't hear.
Sorry.
Closer.
That's it. I think we're ready to go.
Okay.
I can't get people laser powder here.
Yeah.
Put it in your mouth.
I think we're ready.
I think we're okay.
Well, good morning, everyone. And thanks, Tim, for that introduction. And thanks to the Internet Caucus for hosting this event. Our first panel of the day is Living Our Lives Online, Are We Net Ready? And the topic that we're going to address today is the popularity of the internet has risen enormously, but we have an issue is a lack of trust in it keeping Americans from really immersing themselves in the medium. Our panel today will probe all aspects of the consumer trust equation. Just in terms of a few opening comments and thoughts, very briefly. I think it's clear to all of us that in today's world that we must create a culture of privacy and security to face the challenges on both sides of the equation, but in particularly to ensure data security, that protecting our information systems and networks to safeguard consumer information is important to our nation's economic security and also to enhancing and maintaining trust and confidence. That we see privacy and security as being two sides of the same coin, and that we really our policy is really based upon three main pillars. One is market-oriented technology and innovation, innovative technology solutions. The second important pillar, and Commissioner Leibowitz can obviously expand upon this, but is the importance of law enforcement, both on the criminal and civil side, and certainly the Federal Trade Commission has taken the lead in that area. And then the third pillar really is industry leadership and the combination of the public-private partnership and working with government. I pulled some of the figures for e-commerce sales for the last year and a half. Unfortunately, the fourth quarter, the holiday shopping season, the census numbers, that data is not released until the middle of February. But some of the private sector data, there was a recent report from Goldman Sachs, Nielsen Net Ratings, and Harris Interactive that stated that holiday shoppers spent more than $30 billion online in the weeks leading up to Christmas 2005. According to eMarketer, sales over the internet increased by 25% over 2004. The official numbers in this, just compare apples to apples, third quarter 2004, we saw 2% of e-commerce as a percent of total retail sales. Third quarter 2005, census reported that number had increased to 2.3 billion, which as a number is an impressive number, 22, almost $23 billion. But as a percent of retail sales in the third quarter, retail sales is a little bit over, almost $960 billion, almost $1 trillion. So you get the sense from these numbers that we're leaving a lot on the table. And at the same time, we see a lot of, polling data reflected in any number of polls that consumers are losing confidence in the internet and, shopping online. So our panel today, and I think we've got about 50 minutes for discussion, really want this to be informal and an interaction among the panelists. And really to start off, to really think about three questions. Is there a trust deficit? How do we measure it? And then what should we do about it? So to answer those three questions, I'd like to introduce our panelists to make a short, maybe 2 or 3 minutes worth of opening remarks. And what I'll do is I'll just go ahead and introduce all the panelists at really brief. We have a very distinguished group of panelists today led by Jerry Berman. Jerry's the founder and president of the Center for Democracy and Technology. And he's also the president of the Internet Education Foundation. Mr. Berman heads the 200 organization advisory committee to the Congressional Internet Caucus. Next to Mr. Berman, we have Commissioner John Leibowitz. Commissioner Leibowitz joined the Federal Trade Commission from the Motion Picture Association of America, where he served as vice president for congressional affairs from 2000 to 2004. Prior to his position at MPAA, Commissioner Leibowitz was the Democrat chief counsel and staff director for the U.S. Senate Antitrust Subcommittee from 1997 to 2000. Next to Commissioner Leibowitz, we have the Earl of Errol. The Earl of Errol is a crossbench peer who first entered the House of Lords in 1978 and was elected a hereditary peer in 1999. He was educated at Eton College and Trinity College, Cambridge, and is a freeman of the City of London. Next to the Earl of Errol is Peter Cullen, I believe. Peter serves as chief privacy strategist at Microsoft. Before joining Microsoft in 2003, Peter was the corporate privacy officer for the Royal Bank of Canada. And our final panelist is Chris Young of RSA Security. Mr. Young serves as Vice President of Consumer Authentication Services at RSA. He's responsible for driving the company and consumer identity protection strategy, including the delivery of RSA authentication services to provide simple and secure layered and two-factor authentication to all online users. So, Jerry, can you get us started?
Thank you. Everyone on this panel, I believe, is committed to addressing what I think is clearly a lack of trust on the internet by a large margin of consumers. We know the data about identity theft. We know the continuing polling data about privacy online. We know that 29 to 30% of consumers, according to the Consumer Union, have stopped doing shopping online. There are real concerns which in normal times and over the course of my career, I would say we address by reform. And we try to address those issues. There are people who will say we need privacy online legislation. There's the identity theft bills before the Congress. There's efforts to deal with data brokers in the Congress. But I think that we have to recognize that we are approaching a growing privacy crisis. We can do reform, but we cannot take steps backward as indicated in recent weeks by the revelation of the NSA spying program. We cannot have privacy if we have a whole regime of secret law, national security letters demanding information from our ISPs, from libraries, in the name of national security. Of course we have to protect national security. But procedures were set up that ensure that we have checks and balances, whether it's the judiciary for intrusive warrantless wiretapping, or congressional oversight of those programs and any other programs that affect our privacy. Those two pillars are failing. The president is acting around them, I believe, illegally. The congressional oversight committees are not doing their job. The twin pillars of Watergate reform are falling apart, and that has a significant impact not only on privacy but on national security and on the internet, because we cannot have secret law. We need a public consensus of rules to go forward, and without that, I believe that because the internet, email, and communications of Americans are being targeted and we don't know the scope of it, we cannot trust the internet, and consumers cannot trust that they have any privacy guarantees on the internet today.
Thank you, Jerry. Commissioner Leibovitz?
Thank you, Dan, and let me thank the Internet Caucus for inviting me to this second annual State of the Net conference. Workshops, events like this are really fundamental to developing sound internet public policy, and it doesn't hurt that you have a keynoter. Can you guys hear me? Can you hear me? And it doesn't hurt that you have a keynoter like Joe Barton this morning, who really cares about the privacy issues that resonate with all of us, or someone like Jerry Berman, who has been concerned about privacy since I worked on the Judiciary Committee, and I'm very happy not working on the Judiciary Committee now, based on what Jerry said. Let me also add the usual disclaimer, which is the comments today are my own. They don't necessarily reflect the views of the commission or of any other commissioner. This morning's $64,000 question is there a trust deficit on the internet, or are we in the net ready? And from my perspective, the answer is yes and no. A few recent statistics illustrate this dichotomy. 72% of U.S. adults now use the internet regularly. As Dan mentioned, in the recent 2005 holiday season, online shopping totaled something more than $30 billion. But on the other side of the ledger, consumers remain wary of the internet, and with good reason. About three quarters of people, when polled, I think for a Harris Interactive survey, found that they had little confidence that their personal information would be protected from third parties or spam. And meanwhile, there's an other group of consumers who are in many ways far worse off, those who are blissfully unaware of how the internet works at all. An Annenberg study released in June 2005 found that 75% of respondents believe that when a website has a privacy policy, just a privacy policy, it means that the site won't share their information with other websites and companies. At the FTC, of course, the privacy and security of consumers' personal information is one of our highest priorities, and we wrestle with issues, as Dan mentioned, ranging from spam to spyware to identity theft to data security on a daily basis. Over the past several years, the FTC has filed over 100 related cases, over 80 spam cases, many recent ones involving canned spam, which is almost a strict liability statute, makes it easier to bring spam cases, more than 10 data security cases, including a record-setting $15 million settlement with ChoicePoint just a couple of weeks ago. That sends a strong signal to industry that it needs to protect sensitive consumer data, do a better job of protecting sensitive consumer data. In the last year, we brought six spyware and adware cases. Sadly, this is a growth area for us at the commission. Obviously, there's no panacea for the serious problems that plague cyberspace. The best approach, I think we all know, involves a combination of aggressive law enforcement, and we try to be a part of that, consumer education, private sector initiatives, and, of course, better and improved technology. Beyond that, I'll throw out just a couple of FTC-related ideas for making the net ready, and maybe I'll have a chance to elaborate on them during the Q&A. One is the FTC's cross-border enforcement authority really does need to be enhanced. Internet fraud is increasingly, as you know, global in nature. About 38% of spyware and about 75% of all spam originates outside the United States. Yet the FTC is hampered in its cross-border fraud authority and our efforts because of an anomaly in the law that restricts us from sharing information with our law enforcement counterparts overseas. Gordon Smith, the chairman of the FTC subcommittee in the Senate, has introduced the U.S. Safe Web Act, which would close that loophole. The bill is out of the Commerce Committee. It has enormous amounts of support. It came out of the Commerce Committee unanimously, and we're hopeful that it will be enacted this year. And let me raise a second point also, that ICANN, and I know there's going to be a discussion about this later today, I'm going to try to come back for it, really needs to do a better job ensuring the accuracy of the WHOIS database, especially for commercial websites. ICANN requires domain name registrars to maintain a WHOIS database with accurate names and contact information for website operators, yet too often this data is incomplete, it's inaccurate, it shields the identity of malefactors, and it hampers internet investigations of law enforcement agencies, both here and abroad. I was at a spam conference in England last fall. It had people from law enforcement officers from 27 different countries, and there was almost absolute uniformity that that the inaccuracy in the WHOIS database was hampering law enforcement investigations. And again, you know, those law enforcement investigations are the ones that allow us to go after spammers and other other bad guys and help us really protect the security and the privacy of all consumers. You need to protect the privacy of people who want to go on the internet. There are ways to do that, but there are also ways to maintain accurate information. And again, I'm not going to name names about which domain registrars are the problems, but I will say this. If a few of those registrars, or at least one of them, spent a little more money on enforcing WHOIS requirements and perhaps a little less money on Super Bowl advertising, we might see some improvement in record keeping and maybe in consumer security and privacy. And on that subtle note, I will turn the table over to Laura Darrell. Go ahead.
I want to explain, because it really you just got a little bit about the traditional side for my family, that I've been in software development all my, most of my life. I'm on the Parliamentary Information Technology Committee Council. I've been working with the ID card stuff that's going on, and I was involved with the Regulation Investigatory Powers Act that went through the UK, which regulated official access to your communications data and all those various areas around that. I want to try and change it slightly more, less specifically to from America to look at the effect on the global thing, because the internet is very global. It means that you're all trying to trade and communicate around the world. And the Danish experience that's just happened made me think much harder about certain issues. Because to some people it's a question of free speech, freedom of speech against this, that, and the other, and cultural differences, etc. But as a result of that, one of the Middle Eastern countries cancelled all the Danish companies' contracts overnight. And they lost a lot of business. And that will impact, and it'll probably spread throughout the Middle East. So you're talking about a cartoon being published under free speech actually affecting the economy of the country quite severely. And we have to realize that there's some responsibility attached to some of these things and this global internet. You can't assume that you're always right and that your philosophy or your moral outlook on life is correct the whole time. I was interested this morning watching CNN, for instance, that when the editor of the Danish newspaper was trying to demonstrate that they'd been even-handed because they'd got a picture of a bomb with a Jewish Star of David on it, so they'd been having a go at the Jews too, and he then was holding up something that he'd done against the Christians, and the camera switched the interviewer. We never saw it. It was censored out. Because obviously CNN decided it was too dangerous to show in America. Don't ask me what it was. And so I was quite interested by this, and it shows that in public broadcasting, there is a sense of responsibility there, but we haven't got it on the internet yet, and we need to think about that because there are impacts of our cultural differences on trade. And we need to worry about that. We have in the UK another thing, a principle you need to think about possibly. We've got a principle of mere conduit to stop internet proxy servers and internet people being sued for stuff that they just carry without looking at it. We have a concept of if you're a mere conduit, you can't be sued for it. The only problem with that is that if you're trying to moderate a blog or a website or something like, or input onto a thing, the moment you start to moderate it, then you become liable. So how on earth do you filter out legally the stuff that you know oughtn't to go onto it because you've just lost your legal protection? So that's another point to think. The third thing I think that's important with the global aspect is cross-border redress for consumers. Because one of the problems is, I mean, for instance, Sunday night in a few hours in the UK coming from Dubai where I was speaking in an international forum to here, I wasted 2 hours trying to sort out someone who doesn't speak very good English who works for us thing because they'd gone and coughed up £25 to WinFaxer, which is one of your sort of adware, spyware, you know, voluntary download. It comes up and says you've got thousands of vulnerabilities. And this poor chap, and this is the point about this, believed it because it looked authoritative. So he coughed up his 25 quid because he thought his computer was at risk, and on his Barclay card, found suddenly he got all this other stuff and he couldn't get rid of it. Now, the point is that it's an education point that I'm trying to get across here. How do you educate people enough to protect themselves on the internet from these things? Because they suddenly learn they can't trust what's up there. And it's a big problem. Actually, as it was, we sorted it out and rang Barclay Card. They're cancelling the transaction. You know, we knew how to unwind it. But he didn't. He doesn't speak very good English. He speaks good Urdu. But, you know, and the problems with this. And we need to think about how we do this. And this cross-border redress, because there you've got a site that's hosted by, I think, in Nevada. It doesn't have much contact details. You spreading that globally. And we need to think about global redress mechanisms at the consumer level. And I think probably that the credit card companies, certainly within America, are handling it well, and that needs to be extended globally. Certainly the reaction with this was good. And we just need to make sure that we continue all that. The other thing is protecting privacy, and I'll stop very quickly because there's so many different things you can go on to. You have to accept that your data will be leaked. People are corruptible. The weak thing in the chain of people at the end of the day. So my attitude is you don't keep it all in one place. You also allow people to encrypt and have privacy. I don't trust either, I'm afraid, large central bodies not to use this for their own purposes. If you, I mean, the real reason is it's the retrospective aspect of data mining, if they've got a long history of you in your past. This is one of the things I object to in our identity card bill, is the National Identity Register, which is going to track most of your serious things through your life, wherever your biometric identity has been checked. Because you can start to go backwards. And let's say someone becomes a bit of a nuisance politician. How many people here aren't a little bit worried about something they did at university or college or soon after? How many people here have lived a completely unblemished life that could stand up to public scrutiny? And unfortunately, most of the people who are risk takers and become leaders, you've done something silly sometime in their past. And what you don't really want to do is to have them retrospectively discredited for some silly thing they did 20 years ago. And we must not hand that power over to bodies to be able to do, which is what worries me about these ideas of getting data and data mining it for the past. But at the same time, we've got this thing in the UK now of everyone's on webcams, we've got this Big Brother reality TV show. People seem to want to live their life in public, and they can't understand what the problem's about. And balancing these things is going to be very difficult. So I think I better leave it there. I'll be speaking too long.
Thank you. Peter?
Thank you. Thank you to the Internet Caucus for including Microsoft at this event. As you can probably tell from my title, this issue is really core to what I spend all my time on. Let's talk about this trust deficit just for a bit in terms of the landscape. If we think about the last three decades, we've seen this unprecedented growth in computing. What was once a small little network of people playing on toys, where literally a network was somebody taking a floppy disk and moving data from one PC to the other. We've now moved to the PC being a quintessential way in which we live, the way that we work, the way that we enrich our lives. If we think about the number of mobile devices that are in the world today, in many parts of the world, the cell phone is the PC. The amount of data that's moving around globally is just absolutely astronomical. It's allowing us to connect in ways that we just didn't even imagine as little as 3 years ago. But it's also become the attack vector for the bad guys. And this means that information is not only the currency of value, but the currency of crime. So when we think about the trust factor, there's kind of this bad news, good news thing going on. On the bad news, we've got people claiming that they're doing less online. Less online banking. For example, 77% of people are claiming that they're online banking less. 14% are paying bills online less. 30% are claiming they're doing less online in the way of commerce. So this has an enormous impact on the economy. As Dan's figures talked about, we're really not seeing a tremendous growth in the percentage of retail sales coming from online. I think Forrester estimated that the overall economic growth will be undervalued between 1 and 3% as a result of security and privacy fears. There's really another important point about this. It would be wonderful to think about the internet as a direct cause and relationship to some of these issues, but other issues such as data breaches are also delivering this perception that some users have about things not being in control. So that's the bad news side of it. There's a tremendous amount of good news going on. Most of it is because of technology industry, other businesses, other stakeholders such as CDT, government, working together to come up with solutions. These include technology that helps users protect themselves, awareness raising in terms of the way that users can protect themselves, and thinking about proactive legislative approaches that really create a sense of trust and create a sense of control for the users. So there's a tremendous amount of optimism about what has been done and what needs to be done. I think it's fair to say there's still a tremendous amount for all of us still to do. But these are the things, the tensions, the balances that all of us need to think about.
Thank you, Peter. Chris?
Thank you as well for inviting RSA to participate in this discussion. We certainly come at it from a different perspective. We provide data security. We also provide tools directly to consumers and institutions that provide accounts to consumers. We brought some of our own data. We've done some of our own surveys, very well aware of the Gartner studies. Forrester has come out and said that consumer confidence online is waning to the point where they're saying over 40% of consumers have actually decreased their online activity. Fewer consumers are actually banking online, according to some of our largest research firms out there. We did some of our own research. We found that over 80% of consumers are very concerned about things like online account takeovers, online identity theft, of which account takeover would be a subset. But the backdrop to all of this is the internet continues to grow. More people are banking online. More people are transacting online. We heard some of the stats around e-commerce growing, online credit card transactions, online money transfers, online brokerage. Everything that's happening online continues to grow, yet the threats are real. They are prevalent. One thing that's following the growth of online financial transactions is online threats related to fraud against those online financial transactions. We've gone from the days, I started my career in the internet in 1995 before many people had email. In those days, we were worried about things like cyber squatting, you know, somebody registering a domain name that didn't belong to them or belong to a company that was not their company. Now we've evolved to a point where you've got individuals, many of them with attacks that are born from outside of the United States, that are finding ways into the accounts that are owned by consumers, finding ways to impersonate consumers via credit card transactions in an e-commerce site or via online banking sites or via online trading sites so that they can profit from what's happening. No longer, we're moving away from the days of people writing viruses so that they can prove to their friends that they were smarter and their virus was able to propagate itself more quickly across the net. Now we're into an era where many of the fraudsters are looking to profit directly from any sort of virus or Trojan or phishing or, as some of my colleagues say, schmishing attacks, which could be any attack that we don't know about coming next. So the threats are real, and consumers are concerned. Regulators are starting to take notice. The FFIEC, the financial, I don't even know what it stands for exactly, but it's the governance body that includes the FDIC and a number of the key regulatory agencies that focus on the financial institutions. They've come out and said that online financial institutions who are providing accounts to consumers need to adopt stronger measures to protect consumers who are transacting online. They need to match level of security with level of risk, and the level of risk is growing.
I'd be interested in different panelists' kind of thoughts and opinions about, we've laid out the situation somewhat. What do you see as the solution set, and where do we go from here? Well, Jerry, do you want to?
Speaking on the good side, I think that there is now a significant movement of the private sector, led by companies like Microsoft and eBay and HP and others, to establish through legislation a baseline privacy for the internet. And I think that it's going to focus a great deal on recognizing that we have to live through the internet, we do disclose personal information, and that where the consumer needs to trust is in the secondary uses of that information. They want to know that it's, if it's collected and used for the purpose that that they bargain for, that's fine. If it's going to be used for a secondary purpose, they need to give their consent. And there has to be mechanisms both in terms of law and technology that make that possible. The identity theft legislation will do a great deal to try and define that bad behavior. There's a great effort going on to address the spyware issue in this country through both through legislation to go after bad behavior and not the technology, but also to define what are bad practices and what do we need by spyware in order to use technology to filter it out. That effort, many of us in this room are working on with the Federal Trade Commission, the private sector, and our guests from the UK. We need to have a global conversation about this, about how do our solutions stack up against your solutions so that we can have some global dialogue about what we can do, I think, beginning as in the private sector and with consumer organizations and with government, but try to partner as much without over-regulating and stymieing the internet. So we have this twin goal, and I think we can move in that direction. I just, you know, I'll come back and say we can make a lot of moves in that direction, and what is the problem with data retention for all of the good purposes that consumers want, the personalization, the new products, the ability to search, the ability to go, that data retention we have to look very seriously at, because if we have unnecessary data retention, the temptation to use that data for data mining and for other purposes to try and detect crime of all sorts, not just terrorism, is I think, a temptation that the government cannot resist, and it is very difficult to define the rules for that behavior.
Thanks, Jerry.
Go ahead.
Comment. You know, he highlighted a lot about legislation. I want to sort of expand a little bit about that. That I think that's an important piece of the puzzle, but it's not the silver bullet. I think the experience that Microsoft has had in thinking about the spam issue has really helped us understand that there are really multiple investments that are required. Legislation is one piece. Technology is another piece, but user education from guidance is certainly a key part about it. We're absolutely delighted to be able to partner with people like the FTC in terms of delivering really, you know, top-notch content to users about how they can protect themselves. But there's a third pillar which is becoming increasingly important. It's the partnerships between industry, between companies, and between the public and private sector. That is also helping. Things like the various alliances that work on everything from virus protection to anti-spam to some other harms. There's a need for all of us to work together across a very, very holistic set of challenges. But I think the key point is that if we think about all the different vector points, I was struck by Chris's marvelous statement that said that, you know, the risk points are actually increasing faster than risk management. And all that means is we've just got to think about different ways to manage risk. The goal of this is still to help people realize the potential that the internet and technology gives us, and to do so in a collective way, since all of us benefit from that.
Thanks. Sure.
Jump in. I'm going to say something very sort of quickly on one or two of these things. The spam issue I find interesting because at the end of the day, it's a nuisance at the recipient's end, mostly, I think. It's also taking up bandwidth, etc. But it can be filtered, at the internet traffic level. I mean, in Parliament in the UK, we use Message Labs, and it's filtered before it hits your mailbox. And you can filter traffic at a much earlier level, and that would help to reduce it. And equally so, you can have protection at the consumer end. To me, that's not it's not a huge issue. It can be dealt with almost technologically. Regulating is not going to stop spam, because a lot of it used to emanate from spammers in Florida using compromised computers with open broadband connections in Europe, or using computers in Russia. The problem with the global nature of the internet is you may well find the perpetrator and the means of perpetration in totally different jurisdictions. And there are some useful memorandums of understanding which were beginning to be effective, but unfortunately not enough appear to have been signed. It's not my subject, and I think Derek might well cover it later. The other thing I'd like to comment on very quickly is the whole adware thing. Because in people's fury about adware, then they get cross about pop-ups. Now, the trouble is, if you start stopping all that, you can also, you've got to be careful. Yes, you should stop the adware or the spyware stuff, but you've got to be really careful stopping all the adverts, because a lot of websites are actually financed and funded by advertisements. And if you kill the advertisements, you're going to kill the free nature of that website. You're going to start paying. So you're going to look for different business models. So if you want free services on the internet, you're going to have to accept a certain amount of adverts. That's the quid pro quo. So you need to think about where you're going to put that balance, and don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Lays the golden egg, sorry. And don't regulate for cosmetic purposes. I think that's the other thing that sort of I take away from some of the things. It only hurts the legal people. There are some things that you can do. There are some things you can't possibly. However much legislation you get, I'm afraid to say you will not be able to get the correct name and address for everyone who registered a domain name. There's enough ways around that.
Commissioner Leibowitz?
I hate to disagree with my colleague from the House of Lords, even in small part. But I do want to say this about nuisance adware, right, which is adware where consumers don't have notice and consent. You are absolutely right. That a lot of what's fueling this sort of nuisance adware space, sort of pop-ups that you can't uninstall, are legitimate advertisers. They're not doing it directly, but they're going to some intermediary company that maybe goes to an affiliate that embeds software in someone's computers. Having said that, I don't know that you're killing the goose that laid the golden egg if, in fact, you give consumers real notice and consent up front. Then they can decide whether they want the software or not. And I think it's a good trend that that the private sector, including some trade associations, are beginning to write codes of conduct for ethical web advertising that would require upfront notice to consumers. And Trustee is also doing some very good work in that space, as is the Anti-Spyware Coalition.
Right. I didn't mean that they should freely install software on your computer. There's a difference between having an ad. You're just really careful you don't kill all advertising when you legislate against the stuff that takes over your computer.
Well, what spyware is doing is confusing, is giving the consumer no choice over the pop-ups. And when that happens, that spyware is killing the golden goose,
yes,
because consumers say that's all bad, and I'm off the net. And that's why you have to go after the affiliates and the other people who are embedding software on your computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with
that's
that.
A good point.
One thing I would add to that is I do think that there are interest. So one thing that drives a lot of this, as we pointed out, is economics, right?
Sure.
If I can find a way to make money from whatever it is I'm perpetrating, I'll continue to do that. I think it's difficult to legislate against something specific like spyware, because there'll just be something else that we didn't write into the law specifically to focus on. But if there's ways to essentially create economic frameworks, I actually think that some of the things that Yahoo and AOL are doing, where they're charging for certain emails, I think that's may not be the silver bullet, but it's the right kind of thinking around How do we guide this activity so that we reduce the urge for non-legitimate uses of these kind of media and encourage legitimate uses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you said, we're not talking about legislating. I think for the most part, certain types of nuisance adware and lots of spyware are already illegal under the FTC Act, which prohibits unfair, deceptive acts or practices.
I think that there's an overriding principle in that we need to embed in, on top of fair information practices and the privacy and security. We need transparency. That's what the consumers need.
Yeah.
Their information is out there. They need to know how it's being collected and how it's going to be used. That is absolutely critical. Without transparency, there will be no trust on the internet. And I think all of the measures, whether it's anti-spyware, the work against adware, the effort to legislate in this area and to create technology and consumer education, is to move towards more transparency about
the transaction of personal information and our lives online.
And I agree with that entirely, because very often I trust more giving some of my personal information to a website that's going to use it for personalization purposes, and it's unlikely to sell that to anyone else because it wants to keep me as a client, as a customer, because it doesn't want anyone else to have that information because it gives them competitive advantage. And because I know their motives and understand their motives, I'm happy for them to have that invitation. What I think government also needs to be transparent about what it's really after when it's seeking to gather some of this data and when it's seeking to link government databases. And I think we need to, the person who used the internet needs to trust, and that's where the trust comes in, that it really is going to be used for the purpose they say and not suddenly used against them somewhere else. There's this great saying, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you shouldn't be worried about it. But I'm afraid that isn't how life really works. You know, people have an inherent mistrust of someone having control over their life and their actions, and we need to respect that.
Right. Well, there's a reverse of that. If you have nothing to hide, you have no reason to be under surveillance. It's not that...
Exactly. Yeah, no, I agree.
I think, this is certainly getting a good dialogue going. I think Commissioner Leibowitz just hit on a good point that we've all brought out, which is the public-private partnership and the success we've seen over the years, and continue to commend the self-regulatory initiatives, across the board. I think we've got about 10 minutes or so remaining. So really wanted to be able to open it up to questions and have a continue this interaction with the audience. So have any. Any questions? Who wants to go first?
Fall back.
Yeah. But still have them, but still make the information available to government or law enforcement.
I think there is. I mean, I think you raise a very, very important point. I mean, we don't want to chill the free speech rights of the Chinese dissident or the member of the Burmese opposition party. On the other hand, for the most part, the sites that we're concerned about and that law enforcement around the globe is concerned about are commercial sites, and those are different. And my understanding, and Jerry may know more about this, is that there are also ways to protect privacy through things like, you know, proxy registrations.
But I think that the principles, it's almost like the telephone directory. The commercial sites don't have a right of privacy, but individuals do. And in the growth of the blogosphere and individual uses of domain names, there has to be the concept of an unlisted number that also is embodied in the Whois database, which can be penetrated with appropriate process. If someone is engaging in illegal activity, you can go after that. But we have to, I think John makes the great distinction between commercial and non-commercial domain names, and that I think along that line we can arrive at some consensus.
Question down front. We'll come back to you.
Thank you. I had a question for Lord Errol about the status of UK and if you want to expand beyond that to EU data retention laws, where they're moving or whether they're stalled or not. Can you just give us an update on those laws?
It's being discussed right at the moment. The EU is keen to retain data because after we had a couple of terrorist attacks over there, the authorities felt it'd be useful to go backwards and try and work out who connected with who. There are issues behind it about who pays, and there are issues also as to whether the data is useful, because of course it's kept in different formats by different companies, and if you can't actually mine that data, if you can't go back and look at it, are we just lumbering a whole lot of companies with extra regulation, extra costs, which makes them less competitive in a global market, just in order to have something that looks cosmetically good? I'm really not the person to talk on that here. In fact, chap at the back there, Rob Hayes, is really the person to speak to you about whether it's any effective or not. In the UK, the government is paying for it, so therefore there's a voluntary initiative on the telephone side, which seems to be fairly acceptable, and it looks like the stuff will be retained, and people don't have a big problem with that, because it's not content that's being retained, merely who and where and when you rang. There's a bigger problem with ISPs with internet traffic and as to whether it's workable or not. And there are some serious problems there about practicality, which haven't really been worked through. And there's still a lot of fighting going on.
Down front.
Hi, Richard Cena with Webroot. So if there's a deficit in trust on the internet, I believe it's because there's a deficit in good guys that are able to fight the bad guys. Obviously, there are bad guys have free reign to do whatever they want because of the global nature of the internet. No single enforcement agency can do anything. Their hands are completely tied. In recent months, there's been some discussion, maybe not even voiced on the internet, but in private groups, and wondering if anybody here has ever considered or heard proposed Congress or any legislative body issuing letters of marque to good guys to authorize them to actually punish the bad guys.
Anyone?
A trust brand from the government, is that what you're talking about?
So
are you talking more like sort of a bounty hunter going after these people internationally?
Exactly. Unlike, or the same way that we, the United States, countered piracy in the early years of our existence, the same way, and many times that.
It's an interesting idea. In a number of consumer areas, Congress has legislated, speak for our Congress, private rights of action for consumers to go after bad actors. There's a lot of resistance to that from some quarters because the fear of unending lawsuits and frivolous lawsuits directed not at the bad guys but at the good guys. But it's always part of the debate, whether you're talking about privacy legislation, consumer legislation, of creating, that's the bounty hunter, private right of action with the right to collect damages and your legal fees. That's the American way, and it's always debated.
Well, the thing that comes to mind is the ISP right of action in the Can't Spam Act, as an example of that, and some success.
I recall a bounty hunter provision. I think it was suggested by Larry Lessig at Stanford Law School. And you were probably at the commission, and I probably was not, when we issued a report setting out the pros and cons. Right. And that's what we were directed to do by Congress. And we sent it back to Congress, and it sort of went off into the ether.
Really?
So
yeah,
maybe we'll come back and revisit it.
Republish it.
Yeah.
It's on our website.
The biggest danger with this is you suddenly have some, bit like when the privateers sailed the Spanish main, shooting up and getting the bounty off the ships they sank, etc. If one thing's legal in one country, in the internet, we have to start thinking about how we cooperate internationally and understand the differences between our laws and what's legal in a country and what isn't. I mean, take something out of the commercial area, just simply. Adultery, I think, is legal, even though it may cause a divorce. It is actually illegal and is a proper imprisonable offence in various Arab countries. Whether you agree with that or not, that is their law. So, and it's an easy example of something that is completely different because of the cultural differences. So you may have a situation where someone's chasing something that's illegal in America and isn't illegal abroad. Actually, we had it with the whole thing of the commercially, with commissions on the auction houses, which is why one of the chairmen of one of the auction houses wouldn't come to America. It wasn't an offence in Europe or UK, it's an offence in America. And there are some serious problems there with our laws being different. Now, in the internet, if you start releasing people to do that, you've got to be very careful that they're not abusing that to get someone doing something legal in their own country.
Right. I think we have time for two quick questions. Right. So one back in the back, and then you'll get the final word.
Okay, this question is for Chris Young. You said that the silver bullet might be to that email that you can pay to get around certain security provisions. Are you saying that a difference in net neutrality, I know we're going to cover this a little bit later, but that we can essentially, it will merge to a point where you can pay to get around security and protections and stuff like that, and it'll be like a market issue?
So my point was that it might not be the silver bullet, but I think that economic models that try to encourage certain types of behavior can, in certain instances, work. The reason people send out spam, for example, is because the cost of goods, if you're a business person, is almost zero, but they can profit from it because there is a percentage of people who will always respond to a spam email, and that's worth money to the people who do it. So I think what we're seeing with the Yahoo AOL charging a fraction of a penny for emails is they're testing a model which they think will eliminate people taking advantage of their ability to send out spam for free, essentially, and that legitimate advertisers will be willing to pay money. And yes, if there are fraudsters who are making an incredible amount of money, they might pay to get around it, but generally speaking, they're going to go for the path of least resistance. And so some of these economic models can work. I don't know that one particularly will work, but I think it's an important test to see what will work.
Let me just pick up on this just a bit, because I think what Chris is talking about is change in the economies of scale. Right now it favors the spammer. So we've been talking about the good mail type of thing, but it's one possible solution. There's others that are required. There's others that are in place right now. For example, sender ID has proven to be a tremendous success. We now have over 25% of the world's mail, which is being sent under the sender mail program, which again is a different sort of tax that in terms of it identifies the good stuff, which means that the bad stuff we can spend a lot more time focusing on that. So kind of, I think, just to pick up on the silver bullet point one more time, there it is unlikely that we will find the single silver panacea to all these problems. It's going to require multiple investments by multiple partners.
It seems to me that it's worth trying some experimentation here, sort of have little technology laboratories for democracy, but the question raises a good point, because there is a sliding scale to which you end up where, a company is speeding up or slowing down favored content, or content based on whether it's favored or not, and that's obviously a very, very complicated issue and sort of a bedrock principle of the internet. Anyway,
complicate it one more point, which is that one of the glories of the internet is the ability of all speakers to publish and to reach everyone else. And that is, spam is not the only issue. Free speech has blossomed on the internet by the ability of people to speak freely and not pay a tax to get from one place to another. So you gotta be careful in trying to regulate spam, whether you are creating burdens on speech which have made the internet a free speech milieu.
Right. One final quick question.
I wanted to ask a question about Mr. Berman's comment that you were seeing growing support from industry for sort of broad-based privacy legislation, and I wanted to know what kind of indications you're seeing in that regard, and ask the rest of you, do you see movement in that direction? And if so, why do you see that trend, that increasing support?
I know that just a few months ago, it was near the end of the term, when Microsoft announced, after years of being for self-regulation, that they were being ready to pursue privacy legislation, and took that message to Chairman Barton and eBay and HP and a number of others, companies and consumer organizations like my own Center for Democracy and Technology are participating in a dialogue about how to do that. And you heard Chairman Barton talking about introducing that legislation in the House. There's been privacy legislation introduced every year in the House and the Senate, but it has never really been pushed. And the question is whether, I think that we are getting to the point where the need for clear rules and guidance so that people can do business and also protect privacy is leading towards a debate for baseline privacy legislation.
In the UK, we've had a Data Protection Act now for several years. One of the great strengths of the Act, it sets out 8 data protection principles, which I won't go into now, but it would be a very good starting point to look at that, because it's a very good model. Because rules you can get around. It's impossible to control a complex system with rules. All that happens, the network reforms around the rules in an unpredictable way. The great thing about having principles there is the Information Commissioner can use those principles to go against unacceptable behavior and prosecute it. And so it's a very good starting point, that, and take a look at it, the Data Protection Act. It's one of the better things we did.
I think it's a good question, and certainly one that, you know, we're beginning to have the dialogue about. But I think it's also important from a practical level to consider, you know, the effect of the cross-sectoral effect on other industries, in particular the medical community and the financial community. On a practical level, bringing all those communities together to one baseline standard is going to be very difficult, particularly surrounding HIPAA and Gramm-Leach-Bliley, because you have entire industries that have grown up, you know, in a regulated fashion. So with that, I'd like to thank the panelists.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. And please stay in your seats, and we'll move to the next panel.